More people lined up for first-time unemployment benefits.
A surprise tick up in weekly jobless claims.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Adrienne Hilt, and for Jeremy Hobson. It's the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org for Thursday, December 29th.
Mitt Romney touts his business experience as Iowans get set to choose a Republican candidate.
And how do Americans feel President Obama is doing on the economy? Our attitude check a little later.
And gold, usually considered the safest investment, is way down. Should we be worried about that? That's later on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Well, the Labor Department says jobless claims were up 15,000 last week to 381,000, and that's still well below, Adrienne, the critical 400,000 level that indicates some job growth, but it was a surprise jump given the lower trend over the past few weeks. Richard DeKayser is deputy chief economist at the Parthenon Group, and he's with us now from Washington. Hey, Richard.
Good morning.
The first time we've seen a rise out of these jobless claim numbers. What do we take from this latest report?
Well, I think it's important to take it with a grain of salt. These weekly numbers are notoriously volatile, especially during the holiday season when employer behavior is erratic and the government has to do some mathematics to adjust the numbers. That's always suspect. That's why economists look at the four-week moving average. And that actually continued to decline and is at its lowest level in more than a couple of years. So my counsel is don't pay so much attention to each weekly move. Look at the trend. The trend remains downward.
Yeah, that level down to the four-week moving average down to the lowest level since June of 2008. Now, do these weekly numbers, Richard, accurately gauge where the country's job market really is? Or are we just paying more attention because the economy is still pretty fragile?
I think they're giving us a pretty good signal right now. You know, no one economic indicator should be taken on its own, but we're starting to see a variety of labor market indicators moving in the same direction. For example, the National Federation for Independent Businesses, representing small and medium-sized businesses, in November announced that its members were hiring more or planning to hire more than they had also in a little over 2 years. So we're starting to get some consensus now, and I guess that's a good word for the holiday season.
All right. Richard DeKayser from the Parthenon Group. Richard, thanks.
My pleasure.
Well, as Richard and Steve just mentioned, that monthly average fell to its lowest level since 2008. So we were wondering, is this good news today or bad? We wanted to get another take, so we called up David Kelly. He's the chief market strategist from J.P. Morgan Funds. Good morning, David.
Glad to be here.
So we talk about these weekly unemployment numbers pretty much every week, but what do they really tell us?
Well, I think they do tell us that the job market is gradually improving here. The numbers are a little volatile week to week. It's always difficult to seasonally adjust, particularly at this time of the year because of holidays. But overall, the trend does seem to be one of an improving labor market.
And these weekly numbers are only one in a whole sea of unemployment data. Which of these numbers deserve the most attention?
Well, I think the best way to look at the job market is to look at all of them, actually. You look at the weekly unemployment claims, you look at both the household survey and the establishment survey, which comes out on the first Friday of the month. And then you also look at private sector surveys, such as help wanted ads from Monster.com or from the Conference Board. You look at layoff announcements from Challenger Great Christmas. You look at the ISM manufacturing and non-manufacturing employment indices. We look at a lot of numbers to get a very broad picture of employment.
And what do you see?
Well, what we see is a very dynamic labor market. I mean, I think one of the things to think about in this unemployment claims number is that's 400,000 people roughly per week file an initial claim for unemployment benefits. That's 20 million people over the course of a year. And in fact, more people quit a job than actually get laid off. So overall, there are about 47 million people leaving a job every year, but there are about 48 million people being hired. I mean, these are huge numbers. Almost a million people get hired every week in America. So I think even though the overall unemployment rate is high, if you're qualified and if you're aggressive in looking for a job, I think you still can find one in this economy.
David Kelly is chief market strategist with J.P. Morgan Funds. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
Not in New York, where schools there are under pressure to adopt new systems to evaluate teachers and principals. If they don't, they could lose millions of dollars. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR, Amy Scott explains.
The more than $100 million in federal grants is meant to help turn around chronically underperforming schools.
The underlying holdup is really a culture shift.
That's New York State Education Commissioner John King.
In school districts around the country, evaluation happens rarely, if at all, and isn't particularly rigorous.
Unions are at odds with school officials over how to measure good teaching. That's jeopardizing grants in New York, even as other states look to build new evaluation systems. John Tyler is an economics and education professor at Brown University.
Teacher evaluation is one of the major education reforms. It's really sweeping across the nation at this point.
Such systems are a requirement for states that have won a share of $4.5 billion in federal Race to the Top money. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
And Steve, it's the most wonderful time of the year.
Oh, yes, it is.
At least for cosmetic surgeons. Yes.
What?
Yes, cosmetic surgeons. According to the Wall Street Journal, the last 2 weeks of December are the busiest time of year for plastic surgery.
Wow.
In part, it's because for people getting procedures that are covered by insurance, the end of the year can be a really good time to save some money if they've already gone to the doctor a bunch and met their deductibles.
Right, right.
And maybe the bigger reason, because you've got time off around the holidays,
right,
which allows you to heal without walking around the office with that telltale puffiness.
Oh, the puffiness or the scars.
Or just red, yeah.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
Now let's take America's economic temperature.
And the latest poll numbers suggest margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said...
It's time for Attitude Check, and less than a week away from the Iowa caucuses, and Republican presidential candidates are crisscrossing that state, talking about the nation's jagged economy and pinning it directly on President Barack Obama. Well, Frank Newport is editor-in-chief of the polling firm Gallup, and he's with us now to gauge how Americans feel about the president's handling of the economy. Good morning, Frank.
Good morning.
What are voters saying about the president's economic strengths and weaknesses?
Well, interestingly, Obama has a more of a strength in foreign policy than we would think when you look at the big picture, primarily based on the Iraq war ending and terrorism. He doesn't do well at all when it comes to handling the economy. However, when we ask Americans, who do you think would do the better job, for example, on things like handling unemployment and all that, Obama and the Democrats come out ahead of the Republicans.
Previous incumbents who ran with poor but improving economies found different results. Ronald Reagan won in a landslide in 1984. George H.W. Bush lost in 1992 to Bill Clinton. I mean, how does the president compare to those two?
Well, right now, I would say Obama is closer to George H.W. Bush based on all of our indicators. And, of course, that's not good news for Obama and his reelection strategists. For example, economic confidence now, as we measure consumer confidence, is much closer now to where it was under George H.W. Bush than Reagan. And when we ask Americans what's the most important problem facing the country, an important measure is the percent who mention the economy. And right now, that's high for Obama, and that's a lot closer to where George H.W. Bush was than it was for Bill Clinton or for Ronald Reagan, of course, who were reelected.
You think anything, Frank, will even come close to the economy in importance to the president's reelection? I mean, for example, the capture and killing of Osama bin Laden.
Yeah, that's a good question. He, for example, that is, Obama got a bump in his ratings when Osama bin Laden was captured, but you know, it dissipated very, very quickly thereafter. And at this point, we don't see anything else supplanting the economy. We would project that is going to be the dominant issue next year, not foreign policy.
Frank Newport is Gallup's editor-in-chief. Frank, thanks.
You bet.
We've got just days before the Republican showdown in Iowa, and new polling shows Mitt Romney, the former Massachusetts governor, is gaining ground. As part of our series of conversations about the candidates' economic ideas, we're going to talk Romney-onomics with Glenn Johnson. He's a politics editor for Boston.com. Good morning, Glenn.
Good morning to you.
So Romney originally worked in the private sector as the head of Bain Capital, the private equity firm. And I wonder how that experience informed his economic views.
A lot of people think about him as a successful businessman, a millionaire many times over. And that's, in fact, what he's basing his campaign on, this second run for the White House. But then, you know, he likes to not just focus on the money that he made, but also the jobs that he helped create in that capacity. So through his work at Bain Capital, he provided venture capital and support for a variety of companies like Staples, the office supply store. A lot of the critics focus on companies like American Pad and Paper, where the companies ended up either going bankrupt or laying off huge numbers of people or both.
And what about in the public sector when he was the governor of Massachusetts? Mm-hmm. What did he accomplish on the economic front there?
Well, but you got to remember at that time, the state was in a mini recession. And so a lot of what you saw was the sort of mechanics of him as a manager. He balanced the budget, tightened up some regulation, loosened some others, and he doesn't talk about as much about how he did increase a number of fees and things like that in the state. And so while he may not have done a direct tax cut, he did do revenue increases while he was governor as well.
Romney does talk a lot about the middle class, but how in touch is he really with the middle class?
Well, I think in a classic sense, a lot of people, you know, could question how in touch he is with the middle class. He's a real dichotomy in that he's a millionaire many times over, but he's also a very frugal person and hates to see money wasted. Whether or not people buy that, people who are riding the bus, who are struggling to make ends meet, you know, that's going to be one of the points of contention should he be the Republican nominee.
Glenn Johnson is politics editor for Boston.com. Thanks so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Now to the marketplace global perspective, the price of gold has dropped several hundred bucks an ounce in just a few months, set to record its worst month in nearly 3 years. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is with us from London to talk about that story. Hey, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
I know for years the story about gold has been, oh, it's going up and up, and what's going on now?
It's not going up anymore. It's going down. The price has more than doubled since 2008 in August. It hit $1,900 an ounce, but it has now fallen back more than $400 since then.
What's driving the price down, Stephen?
The key factor seems to be the dollar and the U.S. economy. That's what drove it up. I mean, a big part of this was concern about the sputtering U.S. economy and the fact the Fed was printing a lot more dollars to keep the wheels turning. That worried international investors. They thought, you know, too many dollars sloshing around. Let's get out of the dollar and get into something we can trust, a finite supply like gold. Now, in recent weeks, there's been signs of improvement in the U.S. economy. Stephen Lewis, a currency expert with Monument Securities, says that's attracting investors back to the dollar.
There's rising consumer confidence in the U.S. There's an improvement in the labor market. And so that encourages a shift of funds into the dollar. And in rather thin markets, this is pushing up the dollar exchange rate.
Gold is bought and sold in dollars. If the dollar in your pocket is stronger and buys more gold, gold becomes cheaper, the price falls.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Stephen, thanks.
Okay, Steve.
In Greece today, tax collectors are on strike to protest benefit cuts. Across the Mediterranean and Italy, the government there was able to borrow $9 billion to help pay for services. Lots of banks were willing to loan the money, but they demanded a high return. And perhaps most worrisome today in Europe, the euro currency has lost a whole lot of its value in the last week. Joining us now is our economic tour guide, the BBC's Andrew Walker. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning.
So was the Italian borrowing today a good sign or a bad one?
There was some good and some not so good in it, frankly. I think there was some relief that the interest rate on the 10-year borrowing in particular was below the 7% threshold, which is widely seen as a particularly acute warning sign. Having said that, it was only just below that level at 6.98%, so it couldn't really have been much closer. And I think it is a reminder that the financial markets are still not really convinced that the Italian government is going to be able to get on top of its debt problem.
And the euro is also dropping. Has this been going on throughout the debt crisis?
Not throughout it, no. And in fact, in the first 5 months or so of this year, the euro actually gained about 18 cents against the US dollar. There's been a period in which markets have focused, I think, on some of the potential benefits there might be for the euro if, say, some of the weaker economies were to peel off.
And why the big drop this week?
Well, I think there's one particular thing that's been concerning markets, and that's been some renewed evidence of weakness in the European banking system. The banks have been putting an increasingly large amount of money on deposit with the European Central Bank, where they only earn an interest rate of 0.25%. They could earn more by lending it to other banks, but the fact that they're not doing so is seen as an indication that the banks generally are very worried about the financial stability of the rest of the banking system.
The BBC's Andrew Walker, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Well, we've got some juicy bits of fast food news this morning,
Adrian. My favorite news.
No, this is our fast food segment. First in Japan, where the chain Wendy's has returned to the country after a two-year absence.
They're planning to offer a premium menu that includes a burger topped with foie gras, Steve.
Mm.
It'll set you back $16.
That's a lot of money for a burger. Yeah.
You know, it might not be appealing to some people out there. Maybe there are some folks out there who just aren't fast food fans. And if that's the case, I would advise them to consider Bolivia.
Bolivia?
Yes. McDonald's there has decided to close up all of its restaurants.
Wow.
Yeah. For more, we go to Monica Machikau. She's a journalist with Reuters living in Bolivia. Good morning, Monica.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. Tell me, why did these McDonald's in Bolivia close?
There are a number of hypotheses. One of those, people prefer local food rather than McDonald's. It's the fact that it's more cheap, and it's really more tasty.
So the local food is actually cheaper than McDonald's fast food?
Absolutely. Local food can even cost a third of a McDonald's.
And why do you think Bolivia is so different from the rest of the world, where McDonald's seem to pop up everywhere?
We have the Andes, we have the Amazon, and we can really mixture things from the Andes and the Amazon in one dish, which makes it very different, very tasty, and it's part of our tradition for certain.
Before I let you go, let me ask you one more question, and that is, when is the last time you went to McDonald's?
The last time that I went to McDonald's, it was in the United States.
Monica Machikau from Reuters, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Computer hackers known as Anonymous are vowing to release confidential U.S. military and Wall Street documents and emails. That's after the hacker group exposed thousands of credit card numbers from a major security think tank called Stratfor. Marketplace's Bob Moon reports the latest breach is another good reason to use different passwords in different places.
The 44,000 passwords made public so far were hashed, which is computer speak for encrypted. But privacy expert Aaron Titus says his analysis shows roughly half were short enough and common enough to be quickly cracked. Titus says the problem isn't just weak passwords, though. The combination of both username and password can cause big headaches.
If there is a breach at one website, it can have ripple effects on many websites.
That's because we tend to use the same identity everywhere. Todd Feynman, who heads the security software firm Identity Finder, says once a hacker has that combination, it's just a matter of trying out all your locks.
Now they're going to go try and use it at, you know, every banking institution they can think of.
Feynman suggests using split identities and limiting your critical logins to a special few sites. But he concedes your data could still end up being exposed, and he says businesses need to start being held more accountable for better protecting sensitive information.
They have the power to prevent this from happening if they do the right things.
Until companies stop cutting corners, he says, this problem will just keep getting worse. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Now to the dining room, Adrian, and the dry dinner mix market.
Yeah.
Doesn't
that
what sound
is
appetizing?
That?
The dry dinner mix market.
Is it like cereal?
What? Well, these mixes meet a big demand for quick, easy food for frugal time challenge folks. I'm talking about like Betty Crocker's Hamburger Helper.
Got it. Okay.
Right?
I'm with you now.
You add a little hamburger to it, right?
And it stir it up.
Makes a great meal. Okay. Well, you know, Hamburger Helper dominated the market, and now a new product from Kraft has recently started nibbling at that market as well. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer dishes out the details.
Kraft's new Velveeta cheesy skillet mixes target sleep-deprived moms like me. Ads for the mixes feature a hunk dressed up as a blacksmith who lands in your kitchen, puts his arms around you, and helps you mix up dinner.
Just brown the meat, stir in the noodles, seasoning, then smite them. Smite them with the liquid gold until there can be no more smiting.
That liquid gold, of course, is Velveeta cheese. Hamburger Helper uses dried cheese. That difference has taken a meaty chunk out of Hamburger Helper's market share. Consumer economist Sarah Johnson of IHS Global Insight says this is a crafty move because demand for dry dinner mixes is rising in the down economy. More people are eating in.
They're perhaps looking for new products to substitute for the restaurant experience, and this perhaps fits the bill.
It seemed like a possibility for this mom until I realized how much salt and fat my kids would get from cheesy skillets. So it's bye-bye blacksmith, back to boring old fruits and veggies. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
As the days wind down, we're all gearing up for the year ahead, Steve. The resolutions that we'll make.
Yes.
The goals we want to accomplish.
Yes.
The weight we want to lose.
Yes.
And lots of us are breaking out brand spanking new calendars.
Yep.
You know, the ones we got at work or the ones we got as a holiday gift.
But how well is the calendar business really doing at a time when everyone can put that schedule on their iPhone or on their Android? In today's Midday Extra, we ask, are calendars still relevant these days? And Robert Gilbreth is with calendars.com. He's with us to talk about that story. Hey, Robert.
How's it going?
So what were your company's top-selling calendars in 2011?
You know, it's funny. It's sort of always the same in this around the same genre. There's usually a few sort of comic strip ones. Animals are very popular. Dilbert continues to be.
I was going to say Dilbert's
Dilbert forever.
There's always a few sort of family organizational type of calendars. There was a Lego calendar this year that's very popular.
I like the Twilight.
Yeah. Never mind. You have that up in your office.
That's right.
Twilight's always popular. I guess that's coming to an end, though, right?
Team Edward.
Now, who, cats or dogs? Do you know which one wins?
This year, actually, cats are winning.
Wow.
Cats.
It's funny, yeah. Dogs are in the top 10 as well, but there's sort of a box calendar that has a cat picture a day, and that's one of our top five, actually, this year.
Wow. Well, I know, Robert, one of the biggest places you can buy calendars is right there, the bookstore. But those kinds of businesses haven't been doing too well lately. For example, Borders, of course, closed earlier this year, the entire chain. How does that affect calendars?
You know, it's bittersweet for us, right? So they've been our competitor for so long, and you know, and now they're not. So it's, like I said, it's bittersweet. Obviously, it's helped us because that's one less place for someone to go buy a calendar. But we're a big family in this publishing world, and you know, our publishers have one less place now to sell their calendars.
Well, does it affect calendar sales as a whole?
You know what? We're not seeing that it's really affected it. You know, people that want calendars are still going to find them. It's almost like saying, have people stop buying books because there's now not a Borders? Of course not. You know, they're people that want to buy a book are going to go somewhere else to buy it. There's obviously the move over to digital books. It seems like those industries are still moving along.
So when everyone got cell phones, Robert, lots of people stopped wearing watches, myself included. And I wonder if that has the same impact on calendars. Now that we can sort of look up the date and what's happening next week on our phones, do we still need calendars?
Well, of course I'm going to say yes. You know, the difference with our research through the years, you know, we've been in the calendar business. Our parent company has been in the seasonal pop-up calendar business since the early 90s. And you know, what we've seen is that calendars are different than, you know, your analogy from a watch to a phone. The watch itself, you know, for some people, they're not going to give up the watch because it's a piece of jewelry and it's part of their style. The calendar, for some people, it's a piece of their home decor. You mentioned earlier that folks might have got calendars as gifts over Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
That continues to be something, right? Mm-hmm. What we find is that, you know, I love my smartphone, and I do use it, and I do use Outlook for a majority of my scheduling, for doing meetings, you know, share type of things. But I still like to have that visual of, for example, maybe I have the New Yorker calendar on my office wall. You know, so that's something that for me, and I think a lot of our customers, can't be replaced with an Outlook calendar or a smartphone.
Let me ask you one more question, and that is, what calendar have you picked out for yourself for 2012?
You know, I'm trying to think, I have four up on my wall right now. We're obviously in the calendar business. Let me think. I have a San Francisco City Shots calendar. I have a New York City one. I already mentioned the New Yorker. And then I have a there's an advertising poster. So it's all advertising posters from the 30s, 40s, and 50s. That's what's up right now.
Yeah, I've got my parents, actually. I brought them to California, and we took pictures, and my sister made a 2011 calendar last year for that. And so I have that up in my house because it also serves as, you know, great memories.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm still shopping for mine. But, Robert, thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Robert.
Happy New Year.
You too. And tomorrow, Steve, we have another calendar story. We're going to find out why some people suggest we change the calendar altogether.
Change the calendar.
To be better for business. We throw out what we know and start again.
And finally, the calendar, Adrian, will actually lose a day this year in the island nation of Samoa.
So they're going ahead and changing their calendar.
They're changing the calendar there in Samoa. The government is flipping the country to the other side of the international dateline. It says being on a closer clock to its biggest trading partners will help business there. Their trading partners, of course, Australia and China, and they want to be on the same
day. Makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. So come midnight tonight.
Okay.
Midnight tonight, Adrian, there will not be a tomorrow. It will not, the calendar will not change to Friday, December 30th. It'll become Saturday, December 31st.
Now, here's what I want to know. What if your birthday is on the 30th? You just got to skip it?
It just doesn't count. It just, you're not a year older.
So is maybe that, a plus.
I guess you would treat it like a leap year if you're like a February 29th baby, right?
Just don't get a birthday.
You just don't get a birthday. Aww. Or maybe you celebrate it on Saturday. I mean, that's what I would do. Maybe I would celebrate it twice. I don't know. Anyway, besides experiencing time travel, the Samoan government says island workers will still be able to be paid for the day that'll never happen.
That sounds great.
Yeah. So you don't have to work, and you get the money.
Brilliant.
In Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And I'm Adrian Hill. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.